This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Okay, man, first and foremost, before this program starts, go to however you listen to this podcast, go on there and give the podcast a super good five-star review, or as high as the stars go, just go all the way to the right and click the rightmost star so that you get all the stars. And then also, while you're there, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. What happens then is you don't need to go messing around every week getting it. Just comes to you. It's good for you. It's good for us. And go to themeateater.com. Check out the store. We got all kinds of branded First Light apparel and solids and camo, bitchin' hats, shirts. You can also go and get the show notes for the podcast, where if we're talking about books, music, ideas, research, studies, hunting info, fishing info, it's all there in the show notes. So if we're talking about something and you're like, man, I wish I knew what they were talking about, or I wish I could find that book, go there and you'll find the book.
Yeah, you could also read the weekly blog pieces that are often written by Brody Henderson.
Our man Brody Henderson, who's often on this show.
Sometimes by you.
He has a very relaxed, casual tone on this show. So do all that stuff and get it taken care of right away. And now for the show. Dirt, I notice you're running like a chew that has a little package around it, like a Skull Bandit.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Why not the normal kind that just where the little grit pieces get all over your teeth?
Just keep it classy in this nice B&B.
Is that why?
Well, too, I don't have to spit as much.
But you're spitting into that juice bottle?
Yeah.
What gets me is
just disgusting, man.
He's chewing gum, chewing chew, and spitting in a bottle while trying to talk.
Is that nicotine gum?
No. No.
One of my favorite stories of Dirt's is he had a girlfriend down in Arkansas, and he was down there spitting all over the yard visiting her family, and the old man took him aside. Tell that story, Dirt.
Well, they were more liberal people who were barefoot most of the time.
You don't think conservatives go barefoot?
These guys...
I have a lot of conservative views, and I like going barefoot in my yard.
You wouldn't like stepping on wet grass by then either. That's this guy didn't like me spitting where he was stepping.
But I don't think that's not a function of his... politics.
No, that's true. They were.
Do you think that like a conservative would be like, yeah, man, one thing I like is walking in chew spit?
No, that's true.
I do think politics influence people. For like, you know, I've brought up many times is that being gluten intolerant seems to be a left wing ailment.
Yeah,
but I don't think a lack of a desire to walk around and chew spit is part of the political polarization.
That's true. It was. They were right on telling me not to do that. So
they were right wing? Oh, you mean they were correct?
They were correct, yes. I stopped. I'd spit out on the back 40 instead.
You'd take a little walk,
yeah,
and spit over the fence.
Over the high grass area.
That was courteous.
Yeah.
Dirk, did you know that, you know what the word Ursus means?
I know the constellation, Ursus Minor.
Yeah, okay. Ursus is the bear family.
Okay.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Did you know that the Ursus with the greatest distribution is the brown bear / grizzly bear?
No, I believe it though.
Yeah, because you know Eurasia, right?
Oh, the connection.
North America,
yeah.
Just has the widest distribution of any bear. There's many versions of it.
Yeah.
Now it's they used to call the grizzly bear Ursus Horribilis, which is bad PR.
Because what's horrible?
It's the Linnaean
horrible
name.
Yeah,
yeah. So when you get like a Linnaean name, you have. I think we talked about this before. A Linnaean name, like the Latin name, right, is from Linnaeus, and Linnaeus came up with the way we name animals. So the domestic dog is, Canis familiaris, right? That's its Linnaean name. We are Homo sapien, so self-aware human, self-aware hominid.
I don't think we have covered this.
We haven't covered Linnaean?
No, I'm glad we are.
Are we Homo sapien sapien?
Well, yeah. See, that's like that's when things have a that's called trinomial nomenclature. So, the brown bear slash grizzly bear is Ursus arctos, but there's Ursus arctos arctos. Or some people like take the American bison or American buffalo. There used to be this idea that we had bison, which was the plains animal, and then bison Athabasca, which was the wood buffalo of the boreal forest. And we used to just make these determinations were made oftentimes by morphological differences. So you would look and let's look at the structure of an animal, the visual appearance of an animal, and draw distinctions. But then once genetics got involved, it started showing us that things that we thought that measured by that parameter, by the genetic markers, things that we thought were very similar, some things we thought were very similar, are in fact not similar at all. They just happen to accidentally arrive at a place where they kind of look the same, right? And an extreme version would be birds fly and dragonflies fly. So someone would go they must be closely related. But in fact, they came to flight through very different paths. Okay. So there you have a thing where convergent evolution. So yeah, ideas about convergent and divergent evolution. But in those cases, it's there's similarity. There's things that we would see and someone would be they're similar because they both blank. But we realize that doesn't denote a close relatedness. So genetics dispelled some of those misunderstandings, but it also showed us that some things that we thought were very different are in fact very close together. For instance, that the ABC islands in Alaska, Admiralty, Baranoff, and what's that chick? I can't remember the name.
Yeah, I can't remember.
It's Admiralty Island, Baranoff Island, and then the Sea Island. They're together there. That polar bears, those bears on that island are Ursus arctos, okay? So they're coastal brown bears. We'll get more into this in a second. Chickagoff Island, I think is how they pronounce
it. Chicha, yeah. There's CH in both places.
Oh. All right, so that one. Anyway, polar bears are a recent offshoot of Ursus arctos. So polar bears are, if you just from a genetic perspective, polar bears are almost like a cousin of, or almost like a clade of brown bears. And polar bears are very closely related to the brown bears of the ABC islands, even though those brown bears tend to be darker than other brown bear, grizzly bears in other parts of the world. So coloration, if you're you might look and be like, okay, the bears of interior North Alaska, so the grizzlies of the Brooks Range tend to be blonde. So someone might be like, oh, so if polar bears are shoot off of grizzly brown bears, I would imagine they're a shoot off of those very blonde ones that are already in the Arctic on the north slope of the Brooks Range, when in fact those bears are not tightly related to polar bears as are the brown bears of the ABC islands. Now, where was I going from there? Oh, so another added thing of that is, this is the point I was trying to get at, because I'm trying to go way deep. I'm going to talk about a grizzly bear semi-attack, but I'm going way deep because here's the thing. I just want to clarify a point that brown bears and grizzly bears are all Ursus arctos. We used to have this idea that we had all these different subspecies of bears, all right? So we had the Kodiak brown bear, which are the biggest ones in the world. Then you have polar bears, which are their own thing, Arctis maritimus or something like that, Arctis maritimus, something like that, marine bear, is regarded as a different species, though very closely related. And then you have the grizzly bears of the lower 48 and the interior northern Canada. Those are all one species. And the way they talk about it in genetics is they talk about it being clades. So rather than subspecies, they now talk about clades or genetic groupings of bears that are all kind of the same thing. But in hunting lingo, and Rami, you'll be able to chime in on this.
Okay.
In hunting lingo, when someone says a brown bear, what they're referring to is a coastal grizzly of Alaska.
Correct. But now, I've always understood, though, grizzly bears are brown bears, but not all brown bears are referred to as grizzly bears. See what I'm saying? A brown bear is a grizzly. So grizzly can be a brown bear or a grizzly, but you can't call a brown bear a grizzly because it's completely...
Like you're saying, if you were in Wyoming, you would not be able to say, hey, I saw a brown bear. Or you would be able to say, I saw a brown bear.
No, but a grizzly is a brown bear. A brown bear is not a grizzly. The word grizzly is a delineation of where they live.
Yes.
So you would be incorrect saying a grizzly on Kodiak Island.
If we're switching to hunting lingo.
Okay.
Then yes.
But even normal lingo.
No.
Yeah, it's just they're brown bears.
Correct.
Yeah. We're talking, yeah. So, yeah, I think that if you're talking like in Linnaean, like scientific lingo, it would be that
a grizzly is a form of brown bear. Correct. Yes.
Yes.
But just to clarify, because people always get that confused, is like, well, is a brown bear? A brown bear is not a coastal grizzly.
Yes.
A grizzly is an inland brown bear.
Yes.
It doesn't go both ways.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
Okay, yes.
At this point. So that's a good clarification. Like, if you want to go read about the whole broad general family of these types of bears, of Ursus arctos.
Correct. That is
you would begin the top of the funnel, right? We were talking about the funnels earlier.
Yep.
The top of the funnel would be brown bears.
Yep.
And then from there, you will find your way into the Himalayan brown bear, the interior Rocky Mountains grizzly bears. These are all classifications of brown bears.
Of brown bears, yeah.
So, but in the way that hunting type dudes use the term now, when we're talking about a grizzly, we're talking about a grouping of brown bears that do not live in coastal environments and do not have access to salmon.
Correct.
They're not exploiting marine resources.
Yes.
They are in the interior. Those bears tend to have a grizzled appearance. They tend to be silvery, blonde, lighter, and your coastal bears tend to be, coastal brown bears tend to be darker brown.
Yeah.
Running to chocolate. The bears, the largest of this whole group of bears, which are many and varied from Romania and the Himalaya all over the damn place, the largest ones live on
the Kodiak Archipelago.
Yeah. Which includes a Fognak Island.
A Fognak, Raspberry, Kodiak. And those some bears, minor islands.
Did we talk about this the other day?
And the Alaska Peninsula.
And the peninsula.
Did we talk about this the other day that those bears, the bears on Kodiak and a Fognak and Raspberry have been genetically isolated for 10,000 years? Did we cover this?
We did touch it. Yeah.
Okay. So they've been off doing their own vibe for a long time. Yeah. Big mofos.
Very big mofos.
As my son would say. No, bad mofos. He doesn't know what a mofo actually spells out to you, but he knows that there are animals that are counted as bad mofos. I'm just laying a little unnecessary groundwork for what's going to come next. Now, where we left off on the last episode, we were fixing to do some elk hunting on a Fognak. And just as a primer, like if you watch television, you'll know certain television shows after every commercial break, they out of a courtesy, as a courtesy to the viewer and also as a courtesy to their budget, spend some minutes just recapping what they covered a moment ago, which saves them money in production and also like keeps you up to speed if you're just joining the program. Me and Remy Warren drew some elk tags on a Fognak Island. And a Fognak Island is just separated from Kodiak Island by a narrow strait.
And I remember the name now. Copernicus Strait. That might not be the exact pronunciation, but
yeah.
And Raspberry Strait.
Yeah, a lot of stuff out here has a Ruski name, a Russian name.
Russian name. And then there's Shelikov, which is the big, more open ocean between the mainland. That's the real rough seas there.
Yeah, and since we did a real clumsy, recap of general bear taxonomy, let's do a real clumsy recap of coastal Alaska history. Now, the Russians were real heavy, worked real heavy in this area, and they were in the, you know, they would use this area for fur trading. So seal, and they'd come in here primarily targeting sea otters or buying sea otters from indigenous hunters, whaling, all that kind of stuff. And then we bought it, Seward bought it for like $5. And people were real mad at the time that he got ripped off, and turned out he'd gotten himself into a gold mine. So that's how this place came into U.S. ownership. It wasn't $5, but he got a screaming deal. I'm being extreme here in my assessments of what he paid for it. But yeah, he got a screaming deal on it. People were kind of pissed. They called it Seward's folly. Thought he got ripped, but in the end, I mean, the guy did a great turn for his country.
Yeah.
So in some of the areas in coastal Alaska, there's like still kind of a Russian influence in names. You notice in this area in particular, there's a lot of Russian names in this area from the long.
Even the airport, English and Russian.
Is it really?
Yep.
Okay.
All the signs.
Now, so we drew these elk tags. Now, a Fognak Island does not traditionally have elk, and the elk, they captured, I think, 19 or 20 calves in the early decades of the 1900s from the Olympic Peninsula. When I'm in my bedroom, looking out of my bedroom window, I'm looking at
descendants.
I'm looking at the home range, the former home range of the elk that now live on a Fognak.
Yeah.
And they did two releases. One of the releases was just calves, which you think would have just gotten wiped. The fact that that worked is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I can't. That just seems like, oh, hey, what's this?
Yeah, without some like old boss cow, right? Yeah. Without some boss cow who's got some background in dealing with bears, it's just surprising that they could have lived. And it wasn't even that many.
It was 8 Roosevelt elk calves captured on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State in 1928.
And then they didn't even cut them loose till 29, so they somehow kept the sons of bitches alive for a year. Turned them loose on that hellhole. But the thing they had going for them is a familiar terrain. Like right. Dank,
wet,
just dank, nasty. Wet, nasty. Exactly.
Is the Olympic Peninsula is pretty steep too, isn't it? I mean, it goes from sea level straight up.
Dude, it's vicious.
Yeah,
it's viciously steep, viciously thick. Guys that can go, you know, guys that can routinely go in there on public ground and kill elk.
Oh yeah,
in coastal Washington.
Pat yourself on the back.
Yeah, it's like I haven't done it. I haven't even given it a shot. I haven't been there that long and haven't really given it much, haven't given it any shot yet. But I know enough to know that a dude who can consistently fill an elk tag in coastal Washington on public ground is a hunter's hunter.
Oh, yeah.
Bad mofo.
Yeah. A bad mofo that is consistently doing that. Jason Phelps, he cut his teeth on that. The game call maker, Jason Phelps, that's his world, man. So the fact that, like, that him and his buddies like do it is testament to it's just like nothing. Like, you're not up on some glass and tit like spying on elk and then sneaking over and getting them. You're just in there shaking hands with them.
Yeah.
For those dudes, like, you know, the whole like 60-yard pin, it's like if you're getting a shot, it's 10 yards.
Yeah. Top pin.
Yeah. You don't need the rest. Anyhow, so they got these elk from there, kidnapped them.
I got a question.
Lay it on me.
It may be premature.
Oh, it was a chair.
But did the elk that got relocated to Fognak, have their size and like general demeanor paralleled the native Olympic Peninsula elk?
That's a great question, Dirt. I'm glad you asked it. Roosevelt elk are the biggest of the elk. Now, Remy, you can answer this.
Largest body size.
So you have for elk, man, this is turning into a taxonomy episode. For elk, from hunting perspective, elk are elk. They all got the same damn Linnaean name. But we break them up. We break them up into different classifications. They're definitely not subspecies, but classifications. Rocky Mountain, Thule, Roosevelt.
Yeah. And I guess now I could be wrong.
Thule's live in like two places.
Yeah. Well, coastal California.
The valley, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, from like Bishop to the coast. But, and then there's... Maybe they aren't around anymore. Manitoban elk.
Manitoban elk.
Yeah. Okay. And they may have been larger than Roosevelt's, but now currently Roosevelt's.
Yeah, because what was the native elk of like Michigan and Wisconsin?
Probably Manitoban. Okay. I'm not positive.
Because those reintroduction efforts were all done with Rocky Mountains.
Yeah,
so I think
correct.
That elk was probably large, was extirpated.
Yeah.
Man, a lot of like Yanni, are you on this fact checking, man?
I am. You can also
are you like
you
shopping?
Can, you can also throw in.
He's doing an Amazon Fresh order.
Man,
he's like, geez, right?
bananas are
that expensive right now.
I really want to get my new sand volleyball court lines. I've been pricing those out.
So you got you're backlogged on fact checking, Giannis.
Just no, Merriam elk. You could also throw in there Manitoban, as Remy said, Eastern elk. I'd have to dive a little bit farther to see what they think is still alive or not.
Yeah, I got.
But the main species are the Tool, the Rocky Mountain, and the Roosevelt.
Yeah,
just and Roosevelt are the largest bodied. Rocky Mountain are the largest antlers, and just in configuration and size, I would say the Tool elk are the smallest body. And their antlers grow more like a red deer, which is a crowned effect at the tops, just to get a picture.
Yeah. Now, just so listeners don't think we're dumb for not knowing all the answers here, a lot of the answers are unresolved. For instance,
correct.
For instance, of all the types of bighorn sheep, there used to be an idea that there was also the Audubon bighorn. And the Audubon bighorn was in eastern Montana, in the Dakota Badlands, okay? And it had been shot out by miners and killed out by the introduction of domestic sheep and through disease introductions from domestic sheep. Now there's questions of, like, is the Audubon sheep, was it legitimately its own sheep, or was it just a Rocky Mountain? So when you get into all this taxonomic stuff, it's like, there used to be like a set of understandings that is getting eroded by inputs of new information. Like at a time, I think that people talked about 34 types of caribou or some crazy thing like that. And now that list has been greatly reduced to now all caribou and reindeer of North America, Europe, and Asia are now regarded as the same species. Different clades of the same species from a genetic perspective. So, where were we? Oh, yeah. So they take these calves from the Olympic Peninsula and cut them loose out there, and then they do another introduction, and eventually that herd on a fog neck gets built up. You might go like, well, why would you go and turn a bunch of animals that don't belong somewhere loose somewhere? And that's a great question because it's a practice that we were engaged in very heavily in the early 1900s that we're not engaged in now. You would never get the green light now to go and establish a population of elk on an island where they were not native, because the fear would be that you were going to upset a delicate ecological balance. But in the early 1900s and prior to that in other places, there was just this idea that all animals should just be everywhere that it would kind of work, particularly big game animals. So on Kodiak, they cut loose black-tailed deer, which are not native there. They cut loose mountain goats, which are not native there. They cut loose elk on neighboring a fog neck, which are not native there.
As well as reindeer. They call them reindeer because they were a domestic herd that ended up just becoming feral.
Yeah.
So caribou.
So you would never, like, you would never in a million years get the go-ahead to do that now.
No.
Buffalo. But
a lot of it, too. Yeah.
Yes.
A lot of it, too, I think, has to do with the way, if you lived on Kodiak Island during this time when they introduced these animals, you're looking around and you're going, well, this is a land of plenty, but there's not a lot of red meat running around.
Yeah.
There's bears and there's fish. And there is no way to get food to Kodiak Island.
Yeah.
So everywhere else in Alaska, you can set up a settlement and you can go shoot a moose, you can go shoot but you're going to get sick of eating brown bear meat, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So they release these.
Yeah, sick from it.
So they release these animals primarily as a food source to get people that come here go, oh, yeah, I can live off the land here. I'll start a settlement and I'll raise a family and I'll do whatever and we'll make
You're acting like I'm making a value judgment.
No. I'm just saying. Oh, I'm just
the rationale. Adding,
yeah, the rationale of like why then it was even thought of.
Yeah. Now, okay. Let me lay this one on you, because you're at this point on news for an American. You're an expert on New Zealand,
right?
As far as Americans go, I'm not talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
New Zealand, when they were doing all these introductions. They were doing introductions earlier there than they are here.
Yeah.
Than they were here. But there was committees called familiarization committees.
Yeah.
Whose goal, it'd be like sort of the equivalent of a conservation group today called the familiarization committee, I believe, whose goal was to establish the fauna of Europe into New Zealand to make it more like home.
Yeah. So when you're in the park and you see a red squirrel run by, you're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So it was like people just squirrel, back basically. Then were into, yeah, for all kinds of motivations, were into, like, why not have more game animals on the land? Sounds good to me. The funny thing about it to me is that you would never get it to go today. Probably not. Because now you need to establish that it was present and was extirpated by human causes and we don't do introductions, we do reintroductions. If you can establish that it was historically present and wiped out by people, this wouldn't fit. Though during the Pleistocene, there was an elk in interior Alaska, but they cut them loose here because, like, why not? Why not have more meat on the ground? What's funny about it to me is that you have those introductions that occurred, and they manage them in perpetuity, even though they would never get the green light to establish it now. So they're like, well, they're here now. Now we're going to manage it in a conservative fashion. Like, they don't want them to explode in numbers, and they're able to control the valve through how many hunting permits they issue.
Yeah.
So... inadvertently, I now believe they made the most difficult elk hunting on the planet by cutting these elk loose on a Fognak Island. Yeah. If I could go back in time, I would find the guy that came up with that idea and I would punch him in the face. Yeah. So where we left, we were fixing to do some hunting, and it was foggy. You couldn't see shit, right?
And rainy.
Rainy and foggy.
Yeah.
Miserable camping conditions.
Horrible.
At times, miserable camping conditions. But Remy had done the hunt before on a Fognak, and we were kind of like following. Our hunt plan was to mimic Remy's previous hunt plan.
Yep.
Like, Remy's just like, I can't tell you what's going to happen. I don't really know. If it works like it worked before, and we can find him in a valley I found him in, it's just going to come down to, will we get a chance to, like, have a look?
Yeah.
Will the weather cooperate? If the weather cooperates, it's not going to be that it's a challenging hunt. It's just a challenging, like, set of experiences.
Yes.
Right.
Because you've got to get through the shitty weather to get to the point where you can shoot one. Then you have to get that one that you shoot back to camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the terrain lends itself very poorly to easily getting back to camp. Yeah. No two ways about it. It sucks walking through.
Yeah.
It looks nice. You could watch the episode and say, I would make it there in an hour.
Not
4 hours later, you're going to be slogging through stuff, really discouraged.
Well, yeah. We can put some numbers to it. It took us 5 hours to travel 2.7 miles.
Yeah, the way the crow flies.
2.7 miles as to cover 2.7 miles as the crow flies, just, you know, with your travel route deviating from that straight line from topographical features, took 5 hours to travel that.
Not dilly-dallying.
And that that's hard hiking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, yeah. Hiking for 5 hours straight.
Not doing Doug Duren refers to as Jimmy Dickin.
Yeah.
No,
well could be double the actual distance.
Yeah,
easily, I think. Yeah.
I don't think double.
But you can't there's no such thing as walking a straight line.
No.
And there's some major climbing involved in between. And that major climbing, the way that brush is, I feel like it's very similar to walking through knee-deep snow.
Yeah,
or
I was thinking that.
Boot-high snow. The amount of energy going through that.
I think it's even worse because, like, if you get into a situation where the tall grass or, like, the alders grab your leg, then you trip and you don't have that in snow. You know, so, like, you're expending energy trying to keep yourself up when, like, the brush gets too thick.
It's like wading through snowmen.
It's like wading through,
who can grab at you.
Tiny snowmen who want to knock you down the whole time.
Hold on. I want to go back to the point about it being double. Let me explain. Okay. Not only are you going zigzagging, right? Because we like,
you're zig and the zag.
You're going away from camp to get to a pass. And then you go across a ridge up over the top of a small knoll to another pass to then go down. So you've got the zig and the zag. But then also you figure when you're going up, like you said, like camp's only 20 feet over that pass, right? Because you're at the top of the pass and you're looking almost straight down at camp. And so that linear distance as the crow flies is only whatever. What is it? 500 yards? 800 yards? Yeah. Right? Like you can make the shot with a rifle almost.
Oh,
it's
like,
so
yeah,
steep.
You're
actually going down twice that.
Yeah, at the top of that peak that we had to go over, you're at 1550. And camp's at 350. And you could definitely lob a 22 round down into your tent. Not lob. You could shoot a 22 round down into your tent from that peak.
Yeah. Because it's so steep. Yeah. It's steep as you'd want to walk.
Oh, yeah.
Without ropes, probably.
45 degree.
I'm just saying that there's a lot of distance that's not accounted for when you talk about...
I wasn't factoring in the zig or the zag. I was factoring in just the
up and down.
Yeah. Now, on a trail, you're going several miles an hour. A good hiker is covering a few miles an hour on a trail. So that's the thing. So anyways, we finally get, like, you can't hunt... This is a generalization. Generally, with notable exceptions, one cannot fly and hunt on the same day in Alaska because it would encourage the practice of locating animals from the air, landing your plane, and shooting at them, which they don't typically want. And then the places where you can fly and hunt on the same day are places where where the quarry isn't really conducive to that kind of approach anyway. Like generally, like hunting black-tailed deer, it just generally doesn't line out that you would like find a blacktail from your plane, land and shoot it. They're just a different kind of critter in a different kind of habitat. Caribou, it would work out real well, and you're not allowed to do it. You need to have a night pass, and you hunt the next day. So we couldn't hunt the first day we landed. Not that we had any opportunities anyways. Then the next day, it was just fog. And then we hiked up to a spot where we could look down into a valley known to be frequented by elk, based off Remy's past experiences and conversations with pilots who fly over the area all the time. And then just walked up, said, wow, it's real foggy. Walked back down, soaked. The next day, walked up, said, wow, it's real foggy, and walked back down, soaked.
Well,
the next day, walked up, said, wow, it's real foggy, and then we decided to hang out.
Oh, that was the third day.
Yeah.
What day was the day that we walked through the real brushy shit? That was the second day.
Second day, yeah.
That was on our way up to see that it was foggy.
Yeah.
And then we walked time.
That was the third day. We flew. We hiked up to the top direct. Third day was the lake hike.
Okay.
Yeah.
We stayed low and then up.
I'm just clarifying for my own mind.
Fourth day, we went straight up.
Yeah. And sat.
Straight up.
Said, man, it's foggy.
Let's start a fire.
You can see whisperings of clearness.
Yeah.
Coming and going. Devoted a lot of time to trying to start a fire, put up some tarps to get out of the rain. And all of a sudden, I would make like an angel noise, but it wasn't like an angel-like clearing. It was like clouds would blow through. We're saying fog. It's not fog.
It's rain.
You're in the clouds.
Yeah. Clouds, rain.
You're in a cloud. It's not
fog. You're
foggy.
In a rain cloud.
White room.
You're just like up in a, you're like in the thing. When it's raining, the thing that's, the rain's falling out of you, standing in that thing.
Yeah, the ceiling.
Because fog sounds nice.
It's like you climb up into a cloud, and then there's like rain happening around you. Everywhere.
It's like a garden hose with the mist setting on all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But these clouds would blow, and there'd be gaps between the clouds. And during the gaps between these clouds, we're looking down, and lo and behold, ...2.4 miles away, a bull is standing there, like, kind of like sent from the heavens. And then the bull promptly vanishes into a little thicket. And then we notice in a creek bed down below the bull, we notice what looks like two or three other elk that make a little real quick appearance. And they're quite a ways off. And so we started hoofing down toward these elk. Travel that distance, which took a lot of time. So now it's already into the afternoon, right?
Yeah, late afternoon. No time to stop for lunch.
Oh, that's right.
We did not even have time to eat any food.
And find the bull that we saw. Find the bull that was sent from the heavens to walk out of a alder patch and present himself for view. Find him bedded up on a little high spot, a little high grassy, a grassy knoll.
Grassy knoll.
And get a, and here in this area, it's like all grass, like kind of like waist high grass, some chest high grass, some knee high muck. And then here and there, a big ass spruce tree. We get a big ass spruce tree between us and the bull, and the bull's laying there and lays there for a long time, right up until the point where we get about 300 yards away from it, and I'm getting ready to prop my rifle up and take a poke at him should he stand up, and he just walks and vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Crazy.
At this point, we start talking about how maybe it's getting a little late to be trying to do this.
That was at like probably 3:34.
Yeah. We're saying we might, even though it's not dark, it might be getting into foolish territory.
Mm-hmm.
But continue on.
To be shooting
because
bull.
We have to remember, we're still in that giant bear country. But we have yet to see a bear.
Yeah. Evidence of bears. Like bears walk in. The lake we're camped on had what seemed like must have been a pretty healthy sockeye run, just based on the amount of carcasses strewn around on the beach, some bears feeding on them. And while we were in there, there was a lot of steelhead in there and a lot of cohos or silvers are in there as well. And so you'd see some bear tracks on the beach, and then you'd kind of stomp them out and find a new bear track on the beach. And one day on one of the trails up by the pass, we had bear tracks on our tracks. So they're around.
Yeah.
But hadn't laid eyes on them. But you're aware of their presence, and you're mainly aware of their presence because your whole life you've been like hearing about Kodiak bears, right? The bad mofos who adorn the chew tin.
Ursus, what'd you say? Ursus.
Arctos. It used to be Horribilis.
Horribilis.
So like Lewis and Clark, it was Ursus Horribilis. So they got tangled up with them a little bit.
Yeah, they're right.
Now, so we keep pressing on and kind of give up on the bull that we knew about. Remy ripped a few bugles, did some cow call. Nothing in the world was going to stand that. Or we didn't know what he did. He left, laid down, couldn't locate him, couldn't find him.
Can I say something real
Please.
Quick? Please. Something that gave me a perspective on the height of the shit you're walking through was when that elk disappeared. So it's like, on any other hunt, you'll see an animal go into a small like timber stand or tree stand. You're like, yeah, of course it could disappear. This elk, which is massive, what, like how many pounds?
At least around 1,000 pounds.
We didn't cover that. We got okay.
Oh, we didn't even answer
your
question. Ben,
you're proven to be extremely valuable today. extremely valuable.
Whether they were larger or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so when this, so you're looking at this elk and you're like looking at the landscape and it looks fairly close because it is 2.4 or whatever. And then actually when it disappeared, we were 300 yards away.
Yeah.
And he literally, in what looks like, you know, like
a pile of sticks.
knee height bush anywhere else, totally vanishes.
Like ceases to exist, yeah. Vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Like you guys are glassing that small chunk. I mean, it was a tiny area, not a sign of them.
Nope.
But then not. I would say cease to exist, but then all of a sudden he rematerialized later. In fact, had not ceased to exist.
Yeah, he was
just from our
yeah,
view, perspective had just like was no longer on the earth.
Yeah,
was sucked up.
A phantom.
Yeah.
A phantom elk.
Now, so to backtrack to Dirt's earlier point, Roosevelt's are the Roosevelt elk are the biggest bodied of the elk.
Yeah.
But the biggest versions of Roosevelt elk are here.
Correct. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yes, they're the largest.
So they are larger than their native. Yes,
they
Olympic
have course. Bulls up there, here, where we are right now. They have bulls, or within a few miles where we are right now. They have bulls that have tipped the scales at 1,300 pounds.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's like
when
a
you pack
Cyrus
one on the Giants, right? When on the Giants, like they're saying that when you pack one, you could be packing 700 pounds of meat and the
boned
the,
out
skull and antlers.
Yeah,
biggest of the big
giant.
Yeah. That'd be some bone.
Alaska oh, game okay. of fish has 700 to 1100 on average for bulls, which is it's quite a span there.
And that's but that includes the other islands as well. Or is that just...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Raspberry.
Because the ones on
Raspberry
substantially
and...
smaller. Edelin. Edelin, sorry.
So Fognak has the largest of the large yes. Roosevelt elk.
Yeah, but you know, you get these weights, it's like they're varied. But as far as like finding the biggest, you know, if you were going to go out and have like a find the biggest bull thing, you'd go here and weigh all these bulls and you'd yep. turn up the largest specimen. Yeah, and you just look at that, it's like they're just stout, man, like stout. So we keep pressing along because up ahead of us, we got some cows. And then we hear a bugle rip out ahead of us. And normally when you're hunting elk in most places in the Rockies or whatever, you'd hear a bugle rip out ahead of you and you'd sit there with your binoculars for a couple minutes. You'd be like, oh, there he is. But here, that ain't going to happen. And this mountain we're walking across the face of, there is, I'm not exaggerating, there is a full-on balls-out creek every 30 to 50 yards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a it's creek. Like, I don't understand where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And when you get to the creek, it is a, I would say, at least a chest-to-head-high straight drop with Devil's Club in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like ranging from, yeah, you're right, like ranging yeah. from a 6 to 12-foot gully
yeah.
with a full-on creek that you could like set up a grist mill in.
Yeah.
Every fit, like I'm saying, like, I don't know, where is the water coming from?
It's coming from that cloud that sits on top of the mountain like, all day long and all night long.
Yeah,
most days.
Even trying to be like, yeah, so I'll be like to Jan, so yeah, so you'll hit a spruce, then cross 13 streams. Yeah. And the 14th we'll be in the 14th stream bed.
Well, that's like a function too of the you know, which direction the face is pointing, because I feel like on the other side of that
it's
drainage,
not like that.
It wasn't like that, but you still have the same water. It just comes in the form of these like giant, grassy, marshy meadows where the streams, instead of being like that kind of cutty canyon feel to them, it's just like a stream that is just moving through grass. And
so, it's like an alluvial fan where you might hike across 200 yards of water from like the rock guard on your boot up to your ankle that's just kind of moving.
Yeah.
Across like an alluvial fan. Yeah.
It looks like just like a flooded field.
Yeah.
You're just walking in like
with
a flooded
some
field.
Slight
there you go.
Current.
Well irrigated hay field.
Yeah. But with yeah, with
but
some
with
movement,
current.
With
yeah.
a slight movement of the water. So we keep pressing along and we got these cows out ahead of us. And at this point I'm having a lot of trepidation. I'm like aware of the time. I keep looking at my GPS being like, no matter what happens, this is going to turn into a late one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Remy spots, pretty incredible spot.
Yeah. Eagle eye, man.
A real eagle eye, spots a bedded one-horned bull. And what he spots is the antler.
The
so he
tip.
Spots a single antler.
A fork.
Yeah. A fork.
In a pile of branches. Dead
sticks. Yeah.
The a pile of forks.
I kind
of
couldn't believe it. Once you like learning what you're looking at, I'm like, cow, that was a good spot. Laying down, he's got one main beam with 6 points on it. And the way these elk look, they kind of, if you're familiar with a red deer where they get the crowns on top, the way these elk antlers look, they're so compact that they get like a red deerish quality to, you'll yeah. get like a little 3-point crown on top. So he's got like a main beam that comes out of a base that's bigger than a beer can.
Yeah. And I think the way their antlers grow is just a function of their size. They're so big and they've got so much weight that when they fight, you know, they need stout antlers at the base to keep from breaking off.
Yeah.
So the bulls that have the bigger bases and the heavier antlers are going to be the ones that can plow through the
and
other
fight,
elk.
And fight
and
they do.
Fight they do.
So we wound up seeing three bulls. We saw three bulls.
With broken antlers.
Yeah. I think we saw more bulls who were missing. So this dude did bust up. So the way these antlers work is it's way bigger than a beer can when it grows out of his head. But then the eye guard is sort of mashed down into the base as well. So it's like the eye guard seems to almost kind of come out of the base rather than having a chunk that you kind of put your hand around and then the eye guard. It's like the eye guard and the base are kind of mashed together. And it's this really thick, stout antler with very short tines coming out of it. So he's got an eye guard, then two tines, then a three-tined crown coming out of the top. And the whole thing, the whole main beam isn't 3 feet long.
No. Yeah, probably short.
Crazy looking little antler. Yeah. And then one of them, he just snapped off above his eye guard. The thinnest spot is snapped off on it. But he's laying there, kind of unaware of us, but facing us. And kind of mess around, and I'm trying to get lined out on a shot, but he's facing us too much. Now, one time years ago, hunting with Ryan Callahan, I took a dead-on shot on a bull moose, a brisket shot, which would just devastate a deer, right? Basically, that's a little colic that forms on their chest, you know? And I hit that, and it just wasn't a lethal shot on a moose. Just too much meat and bone and whatnot. And I was lined up on him, and I had some sticks in the way. Remy had a clear angle. I moved over. You called at the bull a little bit I was trying to get you to get it to not run off.
Run off,
because he was becoming aware of our presence.
He knew we were there.
Stood up. Eventually, he turned enough where I could snake one in on a steep quartering to a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And that shot would have done the trick. After an autopsy, I realized that shot would have done the trick probably within some number of yards. But he spun, started running, and I hit another one that shattered his front leg, but he already had his lung shot out. And he then tumbled down into one of the deeper creeks and landed smack ass in the water.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
the water. Formed a small dam.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
formed an impound. When he hit the water, he formed an impoundment.
This creek is how far down from probably
30
feet?
Yeah, 30 feet.
30 feet and probably only 10 feet wide.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
That's how steep it was. And there's a waterfall just behind him.
Yeah, it's picturesque.
Yeah, very, very steep canyon. The worst place he probably could have fallen on that hill.
Dude, and the minute that happened and the minute I walked over there, it's like, if something's going to be, it wasn't even celebratory because you're kind of oh man, it is getting late.
Yeah.
We are a 5-hour walk from camp and it's
in
already it's evening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's evening now.
Such a big body too.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners that this turns into a grizzly bear story or this turns into a brown bear story. So we start cutting on it and Remy pointed out that he did kind of like having the elk laying in a creek because it was very easy to keep things clean.
Yeah.
You would make a cut and you'd be like, oh man, there's some hair on my knife. Then you just hold your knife in the creek. Or anything. Everything was looked licked clean.
Yeah.
At the kill site. But there was no way to move it around and maneuver. You just had to start working at what was exposed. So we pulled the, skinned it down the spine. Worked a hide off, got a back leg off, got a shoulder off, got a back strap off, boned out the ribs with the gut still in the thing, boned out the neck, removed the head, got a tenderloin out with the gut still in the thing, got it rolled over. And these are 100-pound quarters probably.
Yeah.
The shoulder's probably not, but I think the back legs
The quarters of the front shoulders, I would say, were very similar to a back quarter of a average size Rocky Mountain elk.
Yeah, and I think the back legs were like borderline like moose legs, like probably 100 pounders. Yeah. When you say, Yanni?
Yeah.
Very hard to pick up.
Yeah.
So then we got the whole thing rolled over. Are you still conducting fact checking?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? What are you on?
Well, I'm going through. Remember when we had we did the five questions from Frank Van Manen, talking about grizzly bear.
Okay.
So I just pulled that up. It was just refreshing. So because I know we're gonna probably talk about numbers about
how many exist in the world? 200,000.
Oh no, the like percentages of bear spray versus firearms and that sort of stuff.
Oh yeah, all that stuff that I now know to be. So flipped it over, did the same thing all over again.
Did you guys see the battle wounds on the first side or the second side?
Oh, that's what I wanted to talk about. Well, I was talking about he's a fighter.
Yeah, fighter.
So on his, like, everywhere on him is bruises. And it, like where he fell, it wasn't rocky. So like he didn't get bruised up in his he took quite a tumble.
Old battle scars, some everywhere. Scar tissue, some
neck,
yellow bruising.
Bruising on his ribs. And keep in mind he had that broken antler and he didn't break that antler like, you know, thrash and brush.
I was gonna make a point too about the broken antlers. You see a lot of broken tines in a lot of places, right? Like where I've guided, where Remy's guided, you probably see broken tines compared to broken main beams is probably, I don't know, 100 to 1. Mm-hmm. It could be. Everyone we saw was broken main beams.
Yeah. Now there's competing, theories on why some areas have a lot of broken. Why elk in some areas have a lot of broken antlers? And I'm sure that there's someone that knows the proper answer. Maybe not. I've heard that it has to do with mineral quality, that some elk antlers are inherently weaker. Some elk in some areas produce a weaker antler because of mineral quality in the soils. And I've heard that it's a function of, and Remy shared this one with me, that he believes a better explanation is that it's more of a function of cow to bull ratios.
Yeah.
The amount
of time spent fighting to breed.
Yeah. That in areas where you got, 10 cows for every bull, a bull is able to stay out of skirmishes. But in these areas where you have high bull to cow ratios, they're spending more time in the dominant struggles and they're just breaking more antlers.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the accepted theory down in Arizona.
That's the theory
in the trophy units. Yeah. Is that they're managed very well for a equal bull to cow ratio, and the bulls just have to do a lot more fighting.
Because you go to a neighboring unit that's got the same terrain and everything, but just managed different, not as many broken antlers.
Yeah. Because of the three Fs, fishing, fighting, right?
Yeah.
They don't do one of them. Right? They don't fish, but they spend more. They're able to devote more of that energy to the one F than the other.
Yeah.
So where was I? Oh, flipping. the hole in his rear ham. I'm skinning his rear ham, and I'm like, oh, someone like I must have shot a third time that I forgot about because he has a large wound on his rear ham. But when you skin the hide back, it's like a perfect inch diameter hole punched through his hide. Where a tine punched through his hide and then went into his rear ham several inches.
Yeah.
And it was just an infected mess.
Mm-hmm. Just beat up.
Yeah. He should take up fishing.
Yeah, he should.
So he'd probably do pretty good fishing around there. So that was weird. Trim that all out. So now we're entering in like, so here you are. We got six guys because, me and Remy, and then we have our crew guys and a perk and liability of this line of work is that you get, when you come out, like crew guys get an equal cut of all the meat if they want it, but they also carry it. Would we share if they didn't carry?
I wouldn't expect it to be shared if I didn't carry.
I also wouldn't want, like, I'd
we
feel
would,
bad.
But maybe not as much. Because we share with the office crew as well.
Not on this one.
No.
So when you carry, do you feel...
You're carrying your 1/6 portion.
Yeah, when you... Yeah. So, Ridge, when you carry elk or when you pack meat, do you feel like I'm packing meat in order to get some, or are you like, I'm packing meat just because this is a sucky thing that needs to happen?
A little bit of both. I like, if I'm thinking I'm going to take any home, I'm not just going to watch you guys carry a bunch of weight in some shitty terrain. I want to like help out.
But you guys already have a ton of gear with you.
Yeah. And it, and when we do get strapped up with meat, well, at least me, Garrett's kind of a superhuman dude, so he can still charge up hills, but it makes me a little slower, so I can't like run out and get all the shots that I normally do when we're unloaded. But I just like, especially this one, I just couldn't sit and like hike out with an empty pack.
Cause we're in like a, like just kind of an uncomfortable situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we got all this meat and we know that, because we're going to be hiking and the ground's so bad, like the walking is so difficult. That, and it's already, and it's dark out now, that we know we're not gonna, even though there's six of us and six people can carry, like trail hiking, six people can absolutely move a normal elk with like not that big of a deal, really. Like if you're just like gonna go out, hit a trail, walk for a few miles, you just pick the whole thing up and go. But this is kind of out of the question because we have so much vertical to gain and lose. We're not on any kind of a trail for the bulk of it.
And we have a very large patch of brush. We should also mention at this point, when the last meat went in the bag, it is pitch black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Headlamps.
It's important.
Oh, yeah. Pitch black.
Yeah.
So the first thing we need to do is go, earlier I was mentioning how now and then there's a big ass spruce. We had, before it got dark, identified a spruce tree that would be adequate to get whatever meat we couldn't carry up into the tree. And this spruce was directly uphill from us. So we get done butchering the elk. And the first step is to, because now it's dark and you got a nice gutty smell blowing everywhere. The first step is to try to get some separation of the meat and the guts, thinking that when a bear or any kind of predator really comes in and claims a kill site, I'm anthropomorphizing a little teeny bit, but probably not too much. They know that they might lose it to the next thing up. Okay. So you find a kill and you can't just assume that it's yours for the next 5 days. So what things generally do is devour soft tissue because you can just wolf it down. It's high calorie food and they'll come in and mop up. Like the liver goes quickly, the lungs, just anything you can just soup right up and doesn't take a lot of work. They like to get on that stuff first. So the general thinking in bear country is if you remove your meat, like your bone-in quarters or whatever, remove them from the guts, there's a chance that a bear is going to come in and the first thing he's going to do is claim the thing with the soft tissue, the greatest amount of smell, all the blood. He's going to pick that. And you might grease off with your meat if it's separate. So we move all of our meat, not far, but out of the gully up onto a little grass, another grassy knoll. And then we take half of it, load our backpacks with half of it, and hike that up to a big spruce tree.
Yeah.
And hang half of that up in a spruce about probably 12 to 13 feet up in a spruce tree.
With the theory that nothing can get it.
Yeah. Mature grit, like cubs, brown bear cubs can climb a tree, but eventually, a distinguishing feature, a morphological difference between black bears and brown bears is that black bears have a short, hooked claw. Grizzlies have a long, relatively straight, more sickle-shaped claw. And as a grizzly gets big and heavy, those claws, the way they're long and straight, those claws do not lend themselves to climbing.
They're more for digging.
Yeah, they got a digging claw. They spend a lot more time flipping rocks, digging roots. It's just their food resources are used differently. They tend to live in more open country. Can live quite happily in the total absence of trees. You do not find black bears in the absence of trees.
The old adage is, to tell a difference between a black bear and a grizzly, is if the bear climbs up a tree and eats you, it's a black bear.
That's an interesting thing to bring up. In these in coastal Alaska, the islands, there are some minor exceptions to this, but this is generally true. It's a truism. The islands either have black bears or grizzlies. So Prince of Wales Island is a black bear island, right? Admiralty Island, north of there, is a grizzly bear island. They don't commingle on islands. If it's a suitable habitat, I keep saying grizzly, if it's suitable habitat for a brown bear, that's who's going to live there. If it's black bears on an island, it's because it's not suitable habitat for brown bears. If it's not suitable habitat for brown bears, it's probably all heavily timbered, and there's no open country, and they tend to like open country.
Yeah.
They use it better. So we get it up in a tree because he's not going to be able to climb the damn tree and get the meat out. Then we go back down to by the kill site, get all of our meat, and start hiking at 10:30 p.m. Get to our camp at 3:30 a.m.
Yep.
Eat some freeze dry. Go to bed about 4:30 a.m.
Fairly exhausting.
Yeah. Tuckered out. Tuckered out.
It was a full day.
Full tuckered. Full day. Full on tuckered.
Yeah.
Now, by the time you get like a reasonable amount of sleep, and also then wake up and regroup, like you got a mess, right? You got stuff to clean up. We had to get the meat we brought home, get it situated in a way that we're happy with. We put it inside a hot wire. We have like a little portable hot wire fence. We put the meat inside there, but the next day we wanted to establish another hot wire fence that wasn't the same hot wire fence that contained our tents. Get the meat out of the ground in another tree. So originally, like the night we got back all late at night, we put the meat inside the hot wire fence that also contained tents. And the next day we wanted to get it up in a tree where it could breathe out and be up in the breeze and have its own containment hot wire fence around it. Did all that. Had some show business stuff to take care of.
Oh, while we're
had a
talking,
bunch of fish catching to do. What's
while
that?
We're talking meat, though, because it might be hard to come back to it. But since you guys dropped it off,
you get in your mouth.
Do you see something?
Oh, no. I thought you were chewing.
I have teeth and
I thought
tongue.
You were chewing on like some hard candy or something, which mm-hmm. I thought was disrespectful.
I do have a little pith stuck between a couple of teeth.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
Because the meat hung for, what was it, 3 days, 4 days? And we were a little bit worried about the condition of the meat, but you guys took it to the processor, and I'm guessing got to handle it and look at it and smell it. How was it? Did it fare well?
They thought it looked good. I thought it looked good. What? Yeah, see, now we're, man, talk about, that was a way out of order. That was a way out of order thing to bring up. Looked fine. Looked fine. Yeah, it's not cold here. It's not like a normal, you're in a coastal environment here, and it's like always cold, but never cold.
Yeah, I don't think it ever got below 40.
Yeah, not great meat hanging weather. And when it's real wet, it's all this rain, right? So it's a lot of rain and never real cold. So when we got back, flew out and got back to town, first order of business was trying to find some place that we could get our meat chilled off. Because it was already borderline. And a thing that there's like a smell that like bloody game bags, wet bloody game bags take on a smell that is like a not a good smell. And it's a precursor to smells you don't want to smell. But it's not in and of itself a bad smell. But it's an indicator of bad things could happen soon smell.
It's a little off-putting.
We were in the bad things could happen soon smell phase. From having the meat not being able to dry out because of the rain.
Yeah, it's
everything's
like
wet.
40 degrees.
And it was in a creek, too. So like nothing ever had a chance to dry out.
No.
But yeah, everything's fine. It looked good. They thought it looked good, too. Yeah, we paid some boys to... I like that dude's hat, retired drug dealer. We paid some boys to process and freeze our thing for us. But to get back to where I was, caught some fish.
How did we know the bear fence was hot? Is there a tester or something?
Yeah, I touch the wire and then see what, and then I gauge what kind of jolt it gives me and whether I'm not satisfied with the jolt, whether I feel that it would be a deterrent or not. And I was satisfied with that fence. The point of all this being, we don't strike off to the hanging tree. You ever hear that Bob Mould song, Hanging Tree? Should I throw myself from the hanging tree? You don't know that one? Oh, that's a story we ought to tell sometime. That story about that dude. Did we ever tell this story? The guy, the spurned lover. What's that bighorn sheep hunting area that that dude, Tristan, used to guide in?
His name wasn't Tristan, was it?
No, it wasn't.
He looked like Tristan.
He looked like a dude named Tristan from Legends of the Fall, yeah. But his name wasn't Tristan.
It was
long hair, leather cowboy hat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Aaron.
Aaron, thank you.
Do you remember the story he told us?
Yeah.
So he used to guide bighorn sheep in BC.
Yeah, in the Mackenzies?
Yeah, but it had a name. It's like the blank.
Yeah.
What's a bighorn area up there, Remy?
Like Rocky Bighorns?
Yeah.
In BC or Alberta?
Could be Alberta. The Alberta-BC line. It's a W word.
White?
No.
Oh, I would think like the Canmore. The
Whitmore.
The Canmore.
It was the Whitmore. I remember that because I was on that trip. And there, yeah.
It's an area, I think maybe an area called the Whitmore.
Yeah.
But anyways, you're south of Stone Sheep Country, in Bighorn Sheep Country. I think the spine of that range is the BC-Alberta line. Yanni will look it up. The Whitmore, Winmore, Wilmore.
Wilmore, maybe.
So, just quick digression. This is an interesting story. There's a guy, the outfitter he used to work for, used to have a horse packer. And the horse packer was in camp with his girlfriend, okay? And the horse packer and the girlfriend get in a fight. He grabs a hunk of rope, walks off in a huff, never to be seen again. It became like a mystery. Years later, someone is dicking around in that area and finds a skull and spinal column hanging from a rope.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Did they obviously searched for him when he huffed
searched
off.
For him when he huffed off, but could never find him.
Wow.
Was assumed dead.
Bad argument.
Someone finds a skull and a chunk of spine hanging from a rope from a tree, and they excavate the ground beneath him and are able to match up his buckles from his boots and his rivets and stuff from his jeans with what he was wearing when he vanished. So anyhow, the next day we go back to find our way back.
It should be mentioned that the rest day was a glorious day.
Beautiful. Skies,
drying out clothes.
Yeah. Only day of the whole trip that was bluebird.
Drying out clothes.
But the sun
hooking fish like nobody's
never high
business.
Enough in the sky to actually be.
Yeah, never, so never direct sun. Yeah. Always indirect sun.
I got a bath and it was warm enough.
Did you?
Yeah.
Dirt showered in the creek.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was jealous. But yeah, the sun went from peak to peak on the same ridge.
All right. So the next day we wake up bright and early and strike off for the hanging tree. Takes us, I think, we had a better route. It took us 4 hours to get to the hanging tree. Now, approaching the kill site, the kill site's about 100 yards up a small tributary from the main stem creek of the valley. We approached the kill site from across the main stem to get eye level with the carcass, which is laying down in a tributary on the other side of the main stem from us. And we're able to get a gander in there and see that at least the carcass has not been moved, right? And think of me, if a bear had claimed it quickly, he probably would have drug it off and buried it. It would look different. There's a bunch of magpies in there. And a lot of magpies making a lot of racket, right? That helps alert, you know, predators to something good going on. They feed off that information. But the carcass is there where we left it, seemingly undisturbed. But we still pick a route that goes clear of the carcass up toward the hanging tree. Now, when we get up by the hanging tree, we do a number of things. We got pepper spray drawn. Was your pistol drawn?
Pistol was drawn. Yeah.
Yep.
Pistols out, pepper spray out,
hollering,
making a lot of noise.
Yelling the whole way up.
I was yelling to him, that I got some spice for that meat that he ain't gonna like. Because I had my pepper spray out. And then we told him too that it was if he did like it, it was gonna be followed up with some lead chasers. So we're being very intimidating and hooting and hollering and yelling.
We have not seen anything though. We've
no
seen
evidence
bears,
to think anything
no
is wrong.
Of bears. No. And we glassed that hanging tree, or at least I glassed that hanging tree.
I glassed
extensively
that hanging tree too.
From
I glassed side. It until I could account for everything that was supposed to be in that hanging tree.
Yeah.
So at that point, we've done everything as good as we could do. Now, there's some hindsight issues. No. Okay. From that point, the one mistake I would say, but there wasn't an option. The one mistake is the hanging tree is surrounded by very thick brush.
Yes.
But there was no clear hanging tree.
How big do you think like the diameter around the tree was?
Clearing?
Yeah. Like around, like from the base of the tree to the like circle of brush.
I would say it was a radius of maybe 15 feet.
Yeah,
15, yeah. 20. Yeah.
Basically, the canopy of the tree.
Yeah.
It was a heavy, thick enough tree. An elk must take shade under there when it's sunny, like it ever gets sunny. It must get, because I noticed when we were in there in the dark, there's a lot of elk shit and bedding depressions under that tree. So on a hot day, they must like to get under there, same way cattle will do, and get under there and bed up in the shade of that tree. I noticed that. So in hindsight, it was a shitty hanging tree, but there wasn't like a good version, right?
Correct.
It was just bad. It was a bad choice among bad choices. Yes.
Yeah, you could only have the foresight, having, I think, been there before, to like, as you pull the trigger and you watch your elk die in the daylight, at that moment to then do a 360-degree scan and make a waypoint on the best hanging tree.
And we did that.
We did.
That was the best.
Me and Remy argued about the best hanging tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But our argument wasn't based on
this
clearing. Our argument was based on
proximity.
No. It was based on
routes out.
I was going for a tree in an area that I knew sucked for travel. A side of the drainage that I knew was sucked for travel, but it was a known suck.
Yeah.
Remy was saying, let's go across. It can't be worse.
Right. Because I've traveled across.
And he's like, there are parts that are better. And I said, because it's dark, because we're loaded out heavy, I think we should go for the known suck instead of that. In hindsight, his tree would have been a better tree.
Yeah. So you guys didn't really consider the whole like open.
We were not talking about visibility under the hanging tree.
Yeah.
But either side would have been the same visibility.
Alder hell holes with lots of gullies. So now here's where mistakes start getting made. I get up to the hanging tree and I notice a smeared bear shit. And do you remember, does anybody remember me getting down on my knees to examine that shit?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Because my initial thought was that it looked like a shit that was smeared from a bear track smeared shit. And I got down to examine it, and I'm like, I don't remember that being there, but
it was nighttime.
But it was like nighttime, and it looked like a boot. Then I was like, it must be a boot smeared it. Because it was all smeared out. And I was like, we were stomping all around in here. We must have smeared that bear shit. And it was a salmon-fueled bear shit. It was like that gray mush shit from when they're feeding on salmon, it looked like. And it was smashed. And I looked at that and was like, is that a boot or a bear track smeared that? And then I looked at the tree. And a lot of the stuff was hung up with paracord. And I looked, and the tree, there's like no scratching on the tree, no sign of disturbance. And also, if something was in there really like trying to climb that tree, I felt that he might have actually like busted some of the pieces of paracord in trying to like reach around and do all of his business up there. And I just saw no other evidence except that smeared shit. So then we make a giant mistake and decide to sit down and have some sandwiches. And we had a MSR stove with us. And a pot. And I remember the pot got passed around, and everybody was who wanted a quick Starbucks via was supposed to throw in a small amount of water into the pot.
Mm-hmm.
I dumped half my water bottle into the pot. And there was like a little excavation dugout, and I was sitting by that excavation dugout, and there's six of us huddled on one side of the tree in a space seeing about like what we're in now.
It was, and during this, packs came off.
Packs came off. Pepper spray is on
pack. I set my
pack
in one area, then I got up to grab the pot. Somebody had sat. So now people are actually sitting by packs that aren't there. So my pack is now across from us, which has our my personal bear deterrent, a pistol, and a bear spray.
My pack's leaning against the hanging tree.
Your pack is leaning against the hanging tree because then you moved into my. So we're kind of, we did this weird shuffle where nobody was near their own pack the way that we sat.
But still tight.
We're configured roughly like people in a living room around a coffee table, for instance.
Yeah.
Maybe even a tad tighter than that.
I got to say, too, we were pretty whooped on the hike in, and that was a great spot, taking away any risk of brown bear.
Perfect chill spot.
Yeah,
dude,
perfect
if you were going to eat a sandwich.
That's the spot.
Drink some coffee.
Yeah.
It was like.
It was nice.
Yeah. It was like walking into a nice bed. Yeah.
I even thought about lighting a fire for no reason.
Just to warm
so
up.
Because nice we were dry. Under that tree. Yeah. It was so nice under that tree. The first post-hanging tree selection mistake that we made was that we got under the hanging tree and decided to linger unnecessarily long and let our guard down.
Yes.
What we did that caused us to linger unnecessarily long, let our guard down, and divorce us from our deterrence, being pistols and spray, was the idea that we would have some sandwiches.
Yeah. They would sit down.
And some coffee. So our desire to have sandwiches in an idyllic setting, in the relief of having not had our kill site claimed by a bear, which the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says often happens on the first night, but we had allowed a night and a half to pass.
And to be fair to us, how long was the hike? Into the hanging tree.
4 hours.
4 hours.
Yeah, so 4 hour hike up and then down and through thick country.
And 1.5 nights have passed.
And 1.5 nights have passed. So we got there, we were all pretty hungry.
And it was like, thank God a bear isn't here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
Because based on my hasty bit of sign reading, backed up by Remy's hasty bit of sign reading.
Who also said, oh, looks like a bear had been here.
You said it. Looks like a bear.
Because I came up a little bit later.
But you must not have felt the same as me.
I felt the same as you.
That like it we trampled it.
But I that's why I looked at you and said it like, oh, did you step, you know, like, was this.
But I got down on my knees to examine it.
But I wasn't there for that.
Yeah,
I didn't
and
know
I that. Did a faulty read on that. I'm taking full blame on sign reading faultiness. I saw what I wanted to see, not what was there.
Yeah. Right.
Second mistake was I and others did not say, let's get while the getting's good. Not that that would have, it wouldn't have mattered.
Wouldn't have mattered.
No.
Wouldn't have mattered because it could have been, now we can look and be like, it couldn't have been any better.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah. Every option from here on out is like, it could have been worse. There's no way it could have been better.
Likely would have been worse.
100%.
Because of what I'm going to explain happened.
Because our act of eating sandwiches just, The mistake of the eating the sandwiches was us letting our guard down. But when we got to the tree, our guard would have been down regardless.
Yes.
Our packs would have been off. We would have been in disarray packing up meat.
Yeah.
So there's
and maybe filming. Potentially filming. More distracted
yeah.
by climbing and lowering stuff down
distracted
out of the tree.
Distracted and spread out.
And filming.
And
instead,
filming.
We were clustered.
Taking a break.
Yeah.
So I get my sandwich. Pat makes me a sandwich that is just... I had come off the heels of having had a bad sandwich.
Not just me, though. This was Garrett and Chris helped out with these sandwiches.
So Pat had made me a really bad sandwich a couple of days before, and I was
not
saying
bad,
to him,
dry,
very dry sandwich, and I reprimanded him and told him as much, and told him that when I send the pros and cons, this is going down as a bad sandwich. He hands over a spectacular sandwich.
Best sandwich of the week.
Like sandwich
envy. Pastrami, chipotle, mayo.
Heavily mayoed. Yeah. great sandwich.
Lots of meat.
What, did you have the stove fired up?
Yeah.
Stove was on.
It was running this whole time.
And I was eating my sandwich, and some folks were commenting on why was my sandwich so nice.
That was Remy and I.
Yeah. We were looking at that sandwich.
I noticed him actually looking at your sandwich. I'm like, I've been looking at that damn sandwich, too.
I'm looking at his sandwich, looking at my sandwich, and looking at the meat that was still in the bag, thinking, you know why what? Isn't this is bullshit.
Yeah. I was just opening my mouth and beginning to form a sentence to the effect of, kiss my ass on the sandwich issue, because you didn't see my sandwich last time I had a sandwich, when all of a sudden there was like...
Well, Pat...
Yeah.
Well, stop!
Sorry.
All right? Cow.
Steve will not I do be this interrupted.
For a, I, no, not that I won't be interrupted. I'm like you act like I'm not going through this in a way that makes sense to me.
I think that there is tension in the room. I'm looking around and I'm seeing what I believe to be sweaty palms and people gripping their shirt tails.
PTSD.
You know what I want to do?
And I think that's what's causing this.
I want to have someone. No, I don't. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this, but I have a slight feeling of wanting to have someone else run point on explaining how this went.
I was actually going to recommend that you tell the whole story from beginning to end.
That's not how I'm going to do
without
it.
Without anyone else.
That's not what I'm going to do.
Adding in, and then we can autopsy it.
This is all thought out. How I feel that this should be approached. Unless someone else has really sat down and thought it out.
Not me.
I'm blocking it out.
I'm reliving the experience, not thinking about how to tell people.
I mean, we've taken people from the Pleistocene epic up into the sandwich making.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I don't know that big mistakes have been made.
No, man. None. Keep it going. Solid. Keep it going.
My apologies.
You're doing great.
Yeah.
I register an explosion of holy shitness. Now over to Pat, because Pat is the first person. Pat, what was the first thing amid the sandwich making? What was the first thing that happened?
So I'm listening to everybody, you know, praise me for the sandwiches and
criticizing you for sandwiches past. For sandwiches.
and I'm sitting here enjoying my own pastrami sandwich and thinking how wonderful that pastrami tastes in my mouth.
Uh-huh.
And I hear off to my right some panting, some deep, you know, guttural breathing.
Can you mimic it?
It sounded a lot like a dog panting at first, like from far away, like, and just kept getting a little louder, little deeper and scarier sounding. Sounded angry too, and at first it seemed fake because I was like, no way this is happening.
There's no way when a bear attacks you, he actually makes such a nasty sound.
Yeah, well, and there's no way, like, a bear is actually going to, like, run up and attack us right now. That's just crazy.
Because we're only sitting under 300 pounds of hanging meat.
I mean, it could happen, but you never expect that to actually happen to you.
Yeah, I'm tracking.
And I mean, it was something I was, like, prepared for on this trip, you know? We knew there was going to be big bears out there. We knew there's potential, but you never actually expect to be like straight up attacked by a brown bear. And so I'm sitting there, I hear these noises, and it just like, it's like, okay, this is happening. I think I was the first person to say something like, oh my God, what's that noise? And then all of a sudden, within 2 seconds, there's a bear on top of us.
All right, man. I hate to do this to you. I know that you are on the edge of your seat waiting to hear what happens when the brown bear that we've been alluding to enters this story. It is worth your wait. It's what I'm doing to you right now is awful. It's terrible. If a man did this to me, I would punch him. But I'm doing it to you. You're going to have to tune in next week on the Meat Eater podcast to hear the final culmination, the resolution of the Afognak Island brown bear attack charge mayhem story. Now it's more like
with a little bit of panting.
And then sometimes, not this time, but sometimes you also get this little treat.
Right.
We didn't get that this time.
No.
Tune in next week.